Today on The Explanation, we're going on a roller coaster ride. Ian, do you like roller coasters?
Yeah, I guess so.
I hate them. But we're going to go on the Cuomo roller coaster, talking about how a year ago, we were all in awe of the New York governor's handling of the pandemic and where we are right now, when he's facing impeachment, sexual harassment allegations, and several investigations. So stay tuned. Follow us on your favorite social network. We are at @explanation_pod on Twitter and at @theexplanationpod on Instagram. And you can always reach us at info@theexplanationpod.com. I am Silvia Salazar, founder of Tono Latino, a platform where I love to talk about U.S. politics in a way that doesn't make you want to jump out the window. Imagine we're just sitting down for a cup of coffee and discussing what's going on in this country.
And my name is Ian Stevens. I am an activist and a political scientist, and I run a YouTube channel and a website called The Lucretia Report and LucretiaReport.com, where I try to dispel political myths and teach about policies and politics that can help real ordinary people.
Okay. Ian, as I said, today we're going to talk about what's happened with Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York State. And there is a lot, but we're going to focus on just a few of these things. Andrew Cuomo has gotten a lot of visibility over the past year, especially because a year ago, he was literally like a rock star due to his handling of the pandemic. But let me back up a second and just give everybody a little bit of context about this man from his, you know, personal life and where he comes from. He was born in Queens in 1957, and his father, Mario Cuomo, was the 52nd governor of New York, and he was governor for 3 terms, and that's going to be an important part of my story. So he's been in this political sphere for a very, very long time. In fact, he was his father's campaign manager, and he is a lawyer, he's an author, he's a politician, obviously. He used to be married to somebody in the Kennedy family. So that was a very, you know, political power couple. And then he left his father's administration to try to, you know, build a name for himself. Later on, he was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development for Bill Clinton. But I found out that even at that time, he had some issues with the Housing and Urban Development Inspector General, who's a woman who accused him of harassing her. Not sexually harassing her, but just having a very, very difficult relationship. He was a very difficult person to deal with.
And kind of like bullying?
Yes, exactly. So later on, he tried to run for governor in 2002, but he failed. He later became the attorney general for the state of New York in 2006. And then he finally was able to run and win the election as governor in 2010. So he's been the governor of New York since January 1st, 2011. That's a little bit of his personal background.
I wonder, that woman at the Department of Housing and Urban Development that said that she was harassing him, is she the only one from that stage in his career that we know of that's spoken up about it? Or were there others even at that stage also?
No, there's a lot of history of him being like a bully. Even under his father's administration, he was known as the enforcer. So he has a very, very long history of being a bully. I was listening to a podcast by the New York Times that revealed, I don't remember at what point in his life, that there was like a huge ballroom and somebody asked like, who here has been bullied by Andrew Cuomo? And like everybody rose their hand, that kind of thing. So this is just prominent throughout his entire life. Here's an interesting number. Last April 2020, this man broke records in his favorability ratings. His favorability was at 77%. So I want you to keep that number in mind, because then I'm going to tell you where this is at right now. But as I said, this man, I mean, last year when we heard about the first cases of coronavirus, he started doing daily briefings on TV. This started on March 1st, 2020, and every day for over 100 days, he was on TV reassuring New Yorkers that everything was going to be okay. He was covering all the statistics related to the pandemic, the latest, the number of infections, the number of hospital beds available, the number of deaths. But he was also apparently behind the scenes obsessed with his ratings, and he was asking his people which networks were covering him live and how many minutes he was on it. Like, he was very focused on his image, and all of that description of him, I couldn't help but be reminded of Donald Trump's obsession with the same thing.
I was just going to say he seems very Trumpy.
Very, very Trumpy. I don't know if you saw last year, he even had a poster made that you could buy from his website showing this, like the journey of New York throughout this pandemic. And it has things like Donald Trump sitting on a moon with a little text underneath that says, "It's just the flu." And him with a muscle, like, it's just a, it's a very pretty poster. And in fact, the text on his website says that poster art is something that they did in the early 1900s and late 1800s when they had to communicate something easily on one piece of paper, and he was trying to do the same thing. He had this humongous foam mountain made for his TV briefings so he could show people where they were in the curve. I mean, he was obsessed about getting all this attention.
Hey, let me look up this poster here. What should I search to Google this?
New York Tough Poster. And it's going to be in the governor.ny.gov website.
So this was sold by his official website.
Yeah, I wanted to see how much it would cost, but it's no longer available.
Okay, I'm looking at it here. Yeah, it is like, it is... It's decent artwork. It's not, I mean, a lot of the posters from the early 1900s that they're referencing are like just gorgeous, beautiful artwork. And this one's kind of, you can tell it was like made on a computer, I think.
But it's kind of cool. I mean,
yeah, it's kind of cool. Just because it has, you know, like the shot at Donald Trump and stuff like that, I am surprised that it would be sold in an official state website.
I don't know. I think it's funny. I have no idea how much it costs. So maybe we can look up later how much it is on eBay if anybody's selling them.
Yeah, we should.
But this is where we were a year ago, right? And now this man is facing investigations about sexual harassment and groping by at least 6 women. He's facing an impeachment inquiry because of the investigations of groping and sexual harassment, but also his handling of the pandemic, specifically to nursing homes, which I'm going to tell you more about, and securing COVID tests for his relatives, for his family. But he's still considering running for governor in 2022. It's just...
I heard Giuliani's son is trying to challenge him.
Yeah, I know.
That sounds fun for New York.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting thing. Because of all these things, he's lost a lot of support from fellow Democrats. There's been several requests for him to resign. The 2 senators for New York State, leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer, and Kirsten Gillibrand, both asked him to resign. Most of the state's congressional delegation, including over 40% of the Democratic delegation, have asked him to resign. But the people closest to him say that's never going to happen. Because remember, I told you, his father was a governor for 3 terms. He is not going to do anything less than his father. And that's why he might even run for governor again. That's something to keep in mind. Also, he has a huge amount of money. He has about $17 million in his war chest.
Well, it makes me think of Donald Trump, how Donald Trump kind of showed politicians that if they can just deny and ignore a scandal for long enough, people will forget about it.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, his unfavorability is decreasing over time. And his favorability number, I mean, not back to that 77% favorability that we were at last April, but it is improving, probably because of what you just said.
Yeah, I mean, favorability is like that 77% one. Those tend to be around disasters. If you look at George W. Bush, for instance, right after 9/11, he was at like 90%+ approval. And then it was just kind of a slow decline over the course of the next 7 years or 8 years until he left office at a pretty low approval rating. But, you know, once it got up to that 90%, and then it was just a decline, leveled off at certain points, went a little bit up, but then generally speaking was on the downslope.
One of the biggest things affecting his negative image right now is what I mentioned earlier, the scandal about the nursing homes. So let me tell you about that. So by the end of last March in New York, there were more than 60,000 cases of COVID and the hospitals were filling up. And Andrew Cuomo issued a mandate asking nursing homes to take back residents who had been hospitalized and even new patients, even if they had COVID, which now, knowing everything we know about this disease, you're like, I'm sorry, he did what? And again, he was very much like a rock star. He had his highest favorability in April of last year, his highest in almost 10 years. He was in the cover of the Rolling Stone magazine in May. He won an Emmy for his press briefings. So this was at the top of the roller coaster that we got on, right?
So what was his justification for that move?
He needed hospital beds. I believe that's the reason. He's like, we just need to move them back. But there was something else I'm going to tell you about in a second. But there was obviously a lot going on, and more than 4,500 people recovering from COVID were admitted to nursing homes, and a lot of people were dying. So he rescinded his order on May 10th, 2020, but families of the victims, people that died, were absolutely furious because these people were in a hospital being taken care of. And here's a really, really important piece to this. He insisted that his administration was following CDC guidelines when he issued his mandate, but the New York order did not require nursing homes to adopt really strict COVID health procedures or make a separate wing for patients coming from hospitals. So can you imagine? These nursing homes are told that they have to take these nursing home residents back, and they're not forced to follow strict COVID procedures.
Yeah, I interviewed a few months ago. I interviewed a long-term care nurse who was working at a nursing home. And well, he actually, his job was that he traveled between nursing homes, and it's kind of like a substitute teacher, you know, where he'll like, yeah, fill in where nursing homes need a nurse. And so he had been to a lot of them all over like the Midwest, Iowa, Nebraska area. It seemed like they took very strict precautions to segregate anyone who, you know, not even necessarily that they have COVID, but anyone who seems like they might be getting sick or something into their own like separate facility from the rest of the nursing home population. And I wonder, I would imagine that even without strict, so like guidelines, even without guidelines from the state saying you need to do things like that, I would hope that nursing homes would do it of their own accord. But I also know that a lot of these nursing homes are owned by private equity firms.
Bling, 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 bling.
All right, you're going to talk about that. I'll let you talk about that then.
We're going to talk about this. Don't jump ahead of me. So okay. He's under scrutiny right now because of something else. He actually also added this little provision in his annual budget, shielding these nursing homes executives and like doctors, nurses, hospitals, nursing homes from liability for COVID deaths and injuries. And there's a report from the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, that said that the provisions provide financial incentives to for-profit nursing home operators to put residents at risk of harm by refraining from investing public funds to obtain sufficient staffing to meet residents' care needs, to purchase sufficient PPE, personal protective equipment for staff, and to provide effective training to staff to comply with infection control protocols during pandemics and other public health emergencies.
Well, I mean, that's like the core of the problem with free market capitalism, isn't it? That there's so many industries like this that on their face, you would think that this industry is about providing a good service, helping people, doing something for people. But the way that they're incentivized to profit maximize gives them every incentive to find places where they can get away with not giving the best care.
Loopholes. Sorry. Yeah. So for anybody that I lost because of the legalese on the Letitia James report, basically the FBI is trying to find out, is investigating the Cuomo administration and seeking more information about that provision that I told you was hidden in the state budget that gave nursing home operators legal immunity. This was added at like last minute, and it granted nursing homes and hospitals all these like legal protections against lawsuits and criminal liability for the care they provided to the residents and patients during the pandemic. So by the end of May, over 5,800 people had died either with confirmed or suspected coronavirus in New York nursing homes or adult care facilities, according to the Associated Press. And here's another thing that I alluded to earlier. I just said confirmed or suspected coronavirus cases because they didn't have enough tests. However, there's another part of the scandal with Andrew Cuomo because he was able to secure tests for his family and important political figures. Top health officials prioritized the Cuomo family and other influential people to get COVID tests. So that's also not good.
Are there any estimates of how many of those deaths were preventable? Like how many excess deaths there were?
I didn't see the numbers of how many were preventable. I do have numbers on the discrepancy between the reported and the estimated actual, which is part of the whole scandal. In July of 2020, the New York Health Department said in a report that what happened with the Cuomo order was not a significant factor in these nursing home deaths, that admitting these patients was not bad, that the transmission from nursing home staff members was the primary driver and not Andrew Cuomo's directive. But fast forward to January 2021, we go back to New York Attorney General Letitia James with a report that found that Cuomo's order may indeed have contributed to outbreaks in nursing homes, and also that the New York Department of Health undercounted nursing home deaths by as much as 50%.
So that first order that said that Cuomo's directive was not a problem, when did that come out and who published it?
In July 2020, the New York Health Department said that Cuomo's directive from March was not a primary driver. January 2021, New York Attorney General Letitia James said that it may have indeed contributed to outbreaks in nursing homes and that the New York Department of Health may have undercounted the deaths in nursing homes by as much as 50%.
Does the New York Department of Health work for Andrew Cuomo?
Yes. He appointed the commissioner of health of the state of New York. His name is Howard Zucker. So the New York Department of Health reports to Andrew Cuomo.
So that does present somewhat of a conflict of interest.
Oh, yeah. It would seem. And it gets better. So in March, the Wall Street Journal reported that Cuomo's top aides pressured health officials to change the report and list about 6,400 deaths, but the initial version of the report said there were nearly 10,000.
So the original one was 10,000, and then they pressured it down to 6,400. And that 3,600 that got cut off, that's the 50% that Letitia James is talking about?
Nope, because later on it was closer to 15,000. The numbers just keep going up. Yes. And in February of this year, the New York Post released a leaked audio of Cuomo's top aide apologizing to New York Democratic leadership, saying that they had withheld intentionally some of the data so that the Trump administration couldn't use it against the Cuomo administration and get political advantage in the 2020 election. That, like I said, these scandals just keep piling up around this. But guess what? That's not all. There was another scandal that started around December when one of Cuomo's former aides tweeted that he had sexually harassed her for years, and then more women came forward. He's denied all of the accusations against him. This is under investigation. But it's just another thing to pile on top of all of this accumulation of bad handling of everything.
So how many women have come forward now? It's like half a dozen or something, isn't it?
So far I know it's at least six.
At least six. Yeah, it's like, so I've heard a lot of people on Twitter and whatnot trying to say that, oh, like this is a hit job. And I'm just, that I'm so deflated when I see things like that, because it'll be the same people that look at Madison Cawthorn, for instance, who also has sexual harassment allegations against him, and they go, oh yeah, well, he's on, you know, red team, so he's automatically guilty, but Cuomo's on blue team, so it's a Republican hit job. And I'm like, so there are six women that have come forward, and like, these are mostly Democratic operatives, like people who work in Democratic politics, for the Democratic Party. And if this was a Republican, I feel like a lot of those same people would be very quick to jump on, oh yeah, he's definitely guilty. And it just seems, it's not just red team, blue team. You gotta have values about these things, right?
Completely agree. Same as when you hear news about people in Congress that harassed somebody or had a extramarital affair and then try to cover it up. I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, you need to resign and go away. Bye.
And honestly, holding the standard to both sides gives us more legitimacy when we use that standard. Like, if no one on the left had called for Andrew Cuomo to resign, the next time a Republican is facing a sexual harassment scandal, people on the left would have really no, they'd have no ground to stand on.
I agree. So this is where this guy is at right now. Like I said, he's being investigated left and right by the FBI, by Letitia James, the New York State Attorney General, who, coincidentally, I don't know if she's publicly said that she might want to run for governor, but she's apparently pulling quite well in a theoretic standoff against him if there was a primary for governorship.
She's definitely doing a good job of finding cases that are popular in New York and doing a very good public relations campaign around those cases. Between, you know, this one with Cuomo, the NRA, the investigations into Donald Trump. And like, there's so many businesses that are based in New York. There are so many people doing shady things in New York that it's not hard to find unpopular people doing shady things. But I think the public relations around her investigations has been very, she's not trying to hide anything. She's trying to make sure people know what she.
Exactly. And she's getting, like you just said, she's getting national attention. There's very few other attorney generals from other states that we would recognize instantly as much as we recognize Letitia James, I would say.
Yeah, well, here in Texas, our attorney general has been under indictment for corruption for like 5 years. So,
oh yeah, yours is that. Famous for other reasons.
Ours is not great. Yeah, Ken Paxton, right?
Yes. So this is where we are. But I'm excited because we have somebody that we can talk to who is very knowledgeable about Andrew Cuomo and his administration, and we can dig in a little bit more on what's going on. What do you think?
Well, let's get into it. Our guest today is named Ross Barkin. Ross is a journalist based in New York. He's written for The Guardian, The Washington Post, The New Yorker, The New York Times, New York Magazine, The New York Daily News, The Daily Beast, and lots of other outlets. And 2 weeks from the day this episode comes out, he's set to release his new book, The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, Coronavirus, and the Fall of New York. And we're going to talk to him today about what he's found out about Governor Cuomo and his administration.
Let's go.
Thank you for joining us, Ross. Unfortunately, Sylvia was not able to make this interview because of a scheduling conflict, but she'll be back for next week's interview, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
Very happy to be on to talk Cuomo and left politics and everything else.
Yeah, so like you said, in the first half of the episode, we talked about the Cuomo administration. And one of the things that Sylvia brought up was how Cuomo has always been, even when he was working for his father, viewed as the enforcer, and he's always had a bit of a reputation as a bully. And I want to know what you think is behind that as someone who's looked really deeply into him. And if you were going to try to get inside of his head, do you think that that is just who he is, or is that a political strategy? And if it is the latter, then what's that strategy hoping to achieve?
I think it's a mixture of both. You know, I don't believe there's a secret progressive, you know, hiding in Andrew Cuomo that is kept at bay because he must pursue a certain type of strategy. I do think his politics and ideology are fundamentally not of the left, but he will do left things and achieve left policy outcomes if he's forced into doing them. And you see this pattern throughout his tenure as governor, where popular pressure must be built, deals must be cut, elections must be won, and finally Cuomo gives ground. It's rarely Cuomo out in front attempting to achieve a progressive aim, the exception really being a same-sex marriage a decade ago. It's almost always there must be a fight. There must be a give and take. He must try to sabotage the left, and then eventually the goal can be reached, and maybe he even co-opts the goal for his own ends. You know, the minimum wage fight was a good example of this, where Cuomo mocked and dismissed the idea of raising the minimum wage, later did allow a gradual rise to 15 an hour in parts of the state, including New York City. But the journey to that was unnecessarily fraught and complicated. But your question was about Cuomo, you know, working for his father and his strategy. And yes, he was very much known as the enforcer for his father, Mario Cuomo, who was governor for 12 years. You know, he was the man on the phones, haranguing lawmakers. He was really the person at his father's side, being known as someone who is very difficult to deal with and very intimidating and very scary for lawmakers of that era. It was not a pleasant experience dealing with a young Andrew Cuomo. And fundamentally, if you look at his trajectory, you know, he is someone who believes his father erred in appearing too liberal or having, in some cases, too liberal sensibilities. And what I'll just say as a caveat there is Mario Cuomo actually was not a very liberal governor. But unlike Andrew, he enjoyed being seen as a liberal beacon, especially in the Reagan era. So he was a great orator. He was good in his own way at inspiring hope among the left. But in terms of actual policy achievements, Mario Cuomo did very little for the left. And in fact, quietly sabotaged the left in his own way, like Andrew Cuomo would later do. So, you know, we start from that bedrock and that reality. But Andrew Cuomo rightly saw his father somewhat feckless. You know, Mario Cuomo spent 12 years as governor and had no or few tangible achievements. And his legacy may have been the construction of a lot of state prisons, which is a quite lousy and disturbing legacy. And in terms of actual legislation and big progressive achievements, they're basically non-existent. Andrew, you know, in his defense, has more progressive achievements under his belt than his father did. But he's also someone who has gone even further to thwart and alienate the left, you know, keeping Republicans in power in the state Senate for almost his entire tenure, which really just guaranteed all the recent progressive victories the left has won would come as late as possible. Had Andrew Cuomo been a conventional Democratic governor, you would have seen progressive achievements in 2013, 2014, 2015. Instead, we had to wait until 2019 and 2020 and now 2021. And that was really because of Andrew Cuomo. And, you know, his strategy has always been triangulation. His father was a triangulator too, but was more of a kinder, gentler triangulator. Andrew is someone who is quite the cutthroat triangulator. And you saw this in the state legislature with his support, his very quiet support, very real support of the Republicans. And you see this in his approach to a lot of issues where he will often be on both sides of an issue. He will state support for an issue and then try to sabotage it behind the scenes. In 2019, he almost did this successfully with the push to give driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. The state Senate Democrats were very committed to doing this. Cuomo publicly said he supported the idea, and behind the scenes, he was working aggressively against it and telling the Democrats, if you do this, you will cost yourselves the majority and you will face a backlash from the voters. This turned out to not be the case. The Senate Democrats reached the supermajority in 2020, and Cuomo actually lost that fight. And so it is an example of there were enough Democrats to overcome Cuomo. But even with this new liberal majority, even with Cuomo tacking left in his third term, he was still attempting to sabotage the left on a very important policy goal.
So that seems like an odd strategy, because to publicly support something and then privately push back against it, it almost seems like you would get all of the backlash of supporting that, but then risk it not actually happening and then also get the backlash from people who are in favor of that. So like you would get the backlash from people who are opposed to that policy, conservatives and such, who think that you are trying to push that policy through. But then if you kill it, you get the backlash from progressives and liberals who wanted to see that policy get put in place. So I don't know, what do you think is the thinking there? Because that seems very counterintuitive.
You know, it's a strategy you pursue if you don't want things to happen. I think that is what can be the confounding thing for those who are vaguely familiar with Andrew Cuomo, but are not that steeped in the weirdness of New York politics. It's that Cuomo often will not want progressive policy goals to come to fruition. And he also doesn't want to be blamed for them not coming to fruition. Blamed by regular voters, not progressive activists and elected officials and insiders who know Cuomo's game and call him out. He very cunningly knows that the average person does not pay attention to this stuff. So the average person may see Cuomo on the news coming out in support of a policy and go, wow, Andrew Cuomo supports that. Then the policy is later defeated or dies and they go, well, at least Andrew Cuomo tried. I guess it just didn't happen. And you saw this happen again and again throughout his time in office, where he would be trying to really sabotage a progressive policy goal behind the scenes, publicly either express full support or at least mild support, or at least seem indifferent. Whereas privately, he was anything but indifferent. And it's the kind of strategy you pursue if you don't want to see something happen and you want to trick the average Democrat to thinking you are still a progressive. And it actually works. The playbook, in Cuomo's defense, has been moderately successful in his 12 years as governor, even with the backlash he's facing now, even with his change in fortunes. He's been governor this long, and he's been very good at frustrating, thwarting, confusing his enemies, who are, broadly speaking, anyone who wants to see good progressive policy happen in the state.
Well, I'm going to ask about that because we talked in the first half about the rally around the flag effect that Cuomo enjoyed during the first half of last year, and then the kind of drop off a cliff that his approval had as all of these scandals came to light. But over time, as memory of those scandals is kind of fading further, his popularity has been slowly starting to rise again. And I think it's obvious that he's trying to ride it out and hope that people will forget about these things. I think Donald Trump probably provided a great lesson that that's a possibility, that you can just let people forget about a scandal in a few months. As someone who's intimately familiar with New York politics and who you're in New York looking at how people are responding, how realistic do you think it is that people by election time or by primary time will have forgotten about these scandals?
Well, it's realistic if there's no new developments. Right now, we are waiting on the outcome of several different investigations. It's important to remember that. Right now, Cuomo exists in limbo. He is winning in the sense that as time passes, people forget, they care less. That's natural, right? And the primary wouldn't be till June of next year. So he's got a full year to go. Now, he is contending with a federal investigation into his cover-up of nursing home deaths from COVID. He is contending with a state attorney general's investigation into the many sexual harassment claims against him. So these investigations will have to reach their conclusion at some point and produce findings. Will there be an indictment on the federal level? Maybe not. Good for Cuomo if there isn't one. What will the attorney general's report say? Will it substantiate the allegations? Will it create a new negative news cycle? The state assembly has been in a long-running, somewhat ineffective impeachment inquiry that at this point appears designed to help Cuomo, but a lot of rank-and-file assembly members are getting frustrated with their leadership. And it's possible, if the attorney general's report is damning enough, if there are some new revelations, that the assembly can move to impeach. And will that happen? Odds are against it. I would not bet on it. But there is a non-zero possibility of it happening. It could happen. If there is an impeachment, Cuomo actually faces a lot of challenges in the Senate where the trial would happen. This is not like the impeachments of Donald Trump, where they were doomed from the beginning because the Republican-controlled Senate was never, ever, ever going to convict Donald Trump of anything. You're never going to reach the threshold of votes needed for it. It was always a liberal fantasy that you'd remove Trump from office. Removing Cuomo from office is not a liberal fantasy. It would be very hard, but you could see a coalition of votes among progressive Democrats and Republicans who hate Cuomo, just to give you an example. So that's always important to keep in mind. Can Cuomo survive? Yes. Does he plan to run for a fourth term? Yes, he wants to. Will he resign? Not likely. Now, this primary, assuming there's a primary next year and he gets challenged again, could be Cuomo's most difficult. I did a column very recently about how Tish James, the attorney general, would kind of be the ideal primary challenger of Cuomo because she has some left credentials. She is a statewide elected official, and she also has deep ties in Brooklyn's Black community. And to beat Andrew Cuomo, you must do well with Black and Latino voters in New York City. Andrew Cuomo has always won outspending his opponents by tons of money and running up the score in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx. If a candidate can cut into those margins and do well with anti-Cuomo voters north of the city, that candidate can win. And so that's why I do think ideally a Black challenger against Cuomo would run. And I do think Tish James herself, given her pedigree now as Attorney General, given her ability now to distance herself from Cuomo, she could emerge as that challenger. Will she run? To be determined. We don't know. But I do think she looms over him and could make his life very difficult, particularly because she has ties to many of the same labor unions that he does. She could pick off his support behind the scenes if indeed that's the decision she makes down the road.
Yeah, Sylvie and I did talk about how it seems she's running a very effective public relations campaigns with all of her investigations, which you don't see all attorney generals doing. Can you explain what you mean when you say that the impeachment inquiry almost seems designed to help Cuomo?
Yeah, so it's moving along incredibly slowly, and it's really producing no new updates, and it's been ongoing for months now. The leadership of the state assembly is fairly deferential to Cuomo. You have an interesting dynamic in the state legislature now where the state Senate, which once was controlled by Republicans, has now become very progressive, as a lot of new young lawmakers who despise Cuomo have power. In the assembly, you've seen a lot less turnover. The assembly is a much bigger body, just to give you an idea. There are 63 state senators. There are 150 assembly members. The assembly, of course, for non-New York viewers, is the equivalent of the House of Representatives. It's the state house, it's the lower chamber. So it's bigger. A lot of members there have been there a very long time. There are no term limits. So you have a state assembly members who were there when Mario Cuomo was governor in the 80s. You have state assembly members who have been around a very long time. And with few exceptions, the longer they've been around, the more deferential they are to Cuomo. The more moderate they tend to be, the more less risk-taking they tend to be. Whereas the younger members are really willing to stir the pot. The issue in the assembly is the DSA contingent is still very small, and then the non-DSA progressive contingent still isn't big enough to move the ball forward. So you have this kind of overarching Democratic majority that is cautious and would probably rather not impeach Cuomo. The question will become, if Tish James's report is particularly damning, if there are new revelations, if other allegations are substantiated, whether it was Cuomo forcing his staff to work on his book, which he got a $5 million advance for, whether there's more COVID nursing home revelations, that could force the assembly's hand. There may be pressure built up to push it forward. But as of now, the longer it grinds on, the longer it fades from public view, I'm talking about the assembly inquiry, the better it is for Andrew Cuomo. There's no doubt a long, drawn-out assembly inquiry that goes nowhere is wonderful for the governor.
I think I see some parallels there to the recall election of Gavin Newsom, because California, like New York, is also a very progressive state, and Newsom, like Cuomo, is a somewhat establishment Democrat. And there are a lot of progressives in California who would also like to see Newsom go, but I think the majority of the Democratic Party there would tell you that the recall, a recall is not the way they would want to see Newsom go. How much credit do you think that Cuomo deserves for his handling of the pandemic? Obviously, he's gotten a lot that really brought him to fame. But when we were looking back at it in the first half, talking about the poster that he published, the big mountain that he had made for his press conferences, it seems very, very much for the camera. And I'm wondering if you think that he deserves the credit that he got. Did he make a substantive difference compared to, for instance, Phil Murphy, who's also a Democratic governor in neighboring New Jersey? Or was it mostly optics?
It was mostly optics. I'll say just quickly on the Newsom-Cuomo comparison, I think the big difference between Newsom and Cuomo is Newsom is a conventional center-left Democrat who broadly believes in empowering Democrats, and for all his flaws, does not triangulate in the same way. Partly because California politics probably don't allow him to, but he's been, I think, more, you know, a governor who has not delivered on some promised progressive aims, but he is not probably thwarted the left in the same way that Cuomo has. Cuomo has also been in power much longer. But, you know, Cuomo is very unique in the sense that there's no other Democratic governor in America who would actively support and encourage Republican control of the state legislature. Very, very hard to imagine happening anywhere else. Hard to imagine the reverse happening where a Republican governor wants Democratic control of the state legislature. So just putting that aside as a caveat, in terms of the pandemic response, a lot of it was optics. New York had the second highest death toll in America, second to California. California is twice as large a state. So the death rate in New York was far higher than in California. And if you go by death rate, New York is second in America to New Jersey. So just on raw numbers, New York failed miserably to contain COVID. When you look at other states that had to grapple with outbreaks early in the pandemic, like Washington State and California. California struggled later on, but did a very good job at containment early on that saved lives, that definitely kept a worse outbreak from happening. Even to this day, very, very few people died of COVID in San Francisco. New York City had over 30,000 COVID deaths. So a look at the raw numbers will tell you New York didn't really succeed.
Now, to be fair, New York City is a much bigger city than San Francisco.
Right, but the death rate in New York is far, far higher. So I think, I haven't looked at San Francisco's COVID numbers in a while, but I think it was, I'm not sure if 1,000 people died of COVID in San Francisco. Have to double check. Might have been less. New York had over 30. You know, New York is not 30 times the size of San Francisco. So the death rate in New York City was a lot higher. There was a time in the pandemic where there were individual nursing homes that had higher death tolls than the city of San Francisco. So you look at raw numbers and, you know, that tells one story. New York was very slow to shut down. Cuomo was denying that COVID was a threat well into March of 2020. And that's part of the theme of my book. When people go and read it and they're sometimes surprised to learn that Cuomo was comparing COVID to the flu well into March of 2020, even when it was very clear COVID was spreading and killing people. He was saying it wasn't a big deal. So like Donald Trump, he downplayed the threat. He didn't take it seriously. He stopped New York City from doing its own shelter in place order because Bill de Blasio suggested it, and he hates Bill de Blasio. And then he would do it about 5 days later. But by then, you know, more people had died. So very slow response. Mismanagement of nursing homes, which isn't just a New York story. Other states struggled with nursing homes. New York struggled as well, miscounting deaths in nursing homes, purposefully undercounting them. The mismanagement of the hospital system, very little coordination between public and private hospitals, the attempts to defund public hospitals during the pandemic, which was a frightening fight that the left had to undertake and was largely successful in staving off the worst of the Medicaid cuts to public hospitals. And, you know, the overall chaos of the response led to more deaths. So objectively, little was done well. When New York shut down, the death toll went down. The cases declined and Cuomo got credit for that, and that's fine. The problem is the shutdown happened after most of the death had occurred. So by the time we were shut down, we were in New York pause, you had tens of thousands of people who'd been sickened or died. So it was too little, too late. Then Cuomo tried to implement austerity measures throughout 2020 rather than raise taxes on the wealthy or borrow money. He enacted cuts to the public college and university systems, to local governments in the state. You know, 2020 really was a time of deep economic uncertainty in New York, where it didn't have to be this way. Phil Murphy did push in a tax hike on the rich in 2020. New York got very lucky that Democrats won control of the U.S. Senate and a federal bailout came, but there was a lot of suffering fiscally and, of course, with the virus before then. And any honest assessment of New York's pandemic response will show that on almost any metric, it was not successful. Now, Cuomo was not alone in not succeeding, and I don't blame all the death in Cuomo. I never do. I say it in my book, and I tell people, I don't blame Cuomo for all the death. I really don't. It was a very, very difficult situation. My issue is he doesn't deserve credit for anything. Almost nothing was done well. In New York City, in New York State, we suffered tremendously, and the proof is in the numbers.
Yeah, I feel like this will probably be remembered in New York not dissimilarly to how 9/11 is remembered, as a similarly defining and traumatic event for the city. Before we get finished, I want to ask you two more things. I want to ask you first, if not for COVID, what position would Cuomo be in now? If we had had the same scandals, but he had not had that, well, I guess he wouldn't have had the nursing home scandal, but if the sexual harassment scandals, for instance, had come out and everything before COVID had happened, but COVID had not, what position would Cuomo be in now? And then after that, can you tell us about your book?
Sure. Cuomo would definitely be in a weaker position. Cuomo still retains a lot of support from rank and file Democrats. And a decent amount of that is tied to the belief that he responded well to the pandemic and he comforted the populace during this terrible time. In part, you know, that was a natural response in the time of crisis. In part, it was a media creation. Cable TV, prestige media propped up Cuomo during the crisis, and that image has lingered even as his numbers have taken a hit. You had national magazines putting him on the cover. You had cable TV like CNN celebrating him every day, letting his brother interview him, which was a travesty. Even outlets like the New York Times were not always reporting skeptically in Cuomo. So you had this very profound and powerful media bubble that really created this image of Cuomo, the COVID conqueror, that has not entirely faded. And there's no doubt in my mind that the popularity he enjoyed of last year is still enough to keep his numbers from cratering completely. His overall approval rating is a lot lower than it once was, and even his support among Democrats is lower. But the fact that he can hang on through all of this is a testament to how popular he once was. And in terms of my book, it's called The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, Coronavirus and the Fall of New York, which is a purposeful echo of Machiavelli's The Prince and also Robert Caro's Power Broker, which was the Power Broker, Robert Moses, and the Fall of New York. And it's out on June 22nd. You can still pre-order to get that 15% discount, so I urge you to do that. And it's the first book of its kind. It is a thorough accounting of Andrew Cuomo's failures during COVID, and it's also a political history of Andrew Cuomo. So for those who are interested in what the heck is going on in New York, who really want to know the true story of COVID in New York, I strongly suggest you buy the book and read it. I think you'll find it very interesting. And if you like politics and you kind of want to know the history of what's going on, I also dive into Andrew Cuomo's history in the state, and I talk about his father as well. So you do get that sense of background that I think will be useful to readers. And I really see my book as a rejoinder to the pandemic memoir Cuomo put out last year and made $5 million from.
And if you are listening to this on the day it comes out, it's 2 weeks from today that the book will come out.
Yep, June 22nd. And we're actually going to have a launch party. I will share details on my Twitter at Ross Barkin about that. It will be in person. It will not be a Zoom party. So that will, I think, be exciting to people. It's going to be one of the first kind of COVID era, end of COVID, you know, in-person book events. So I think it'll be a lot of fun for people to be able to gather outdoors and sort of discuss these issues and reflect on what happened. And, you know, like I was saying, you know, I really see this book as a rejoinder to the pandemic memoir that Cuomo put out, which to me and to many others was a work of propaganda. I unfortunately had to read the Cuomo pandemic memoir to do research for my book. And it's amazing how many mistruths, elisions, falsehoods are in that book. And so I really see this book, my book, as a valuable corrective. I hope it's seen that way. Response so far has been pretty positive. You know, we're expecting a lot more reviews in the coming weeks. And I encourage you to buy it. OR Books, that's OR Books, is putting it out. So if you go to orbooks.com, you can find it. You can Google the prints, Ross Barkin, Andrew Cuomo. It should pop up pretty quickly. Like I said, the pre-order is good because you help out authors like myself who really depend on pre-orders to build momentum for the book. And you get 15% off. So it's a win-win situation. So I encourage you to pre-order. The books are shipping now. People have received their pre-orders. So you can get it pretty quickly if you order. And, you know, it's a book that I hope will be of value to people this year and in coming years as well. Since, you know, there will be more pandemic remembrances and analyses. I really see this one as the first one, and that focuses entirely on Cuomo and New York State's response. And I can say there's no other book like it. So, you know, if you get it, you'll have something that is not like anything else that's currently on the market.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us today, Ross.
Thank you for having me. Had a lot of fun talking Cuomo.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. And we'll talk to you later.
Ian, since I wasn't able to join you in the interview of Ross Barkin, what was your favorite part of the interview?
I thought that was really interesting. Ross talked a lot about the way that Andrew Cuomo tries to stymie the DSA, more further left politics in New York. He talked about Andrew Cuomo actually trying to maintain a split legislature in New York, maintain Republican control in the New York Senate, or at least Democrats not having a supermajority in the New York Senate, presumably because once they have a supermajority in both houses, he loses some power.
Irrelevant.
Yeah, they can override him. And he actually talked about that he wrote a column recently talking about how Letitia James would be a great candidate to primary Andrew Cuomo, and I thought that was very interesting.
And we know that she's polling pretty decently in the theoretical polls, but I think you know, and probably my followers know how I feel about polls. So yeah, we'll just see.
Yeah, he talked about how Letitia James has very deep roots with the black community in, I think he said Brooklyn. It was Brooklyn or the Bronx. I always mix those two up. But that if you want to win the governorship in New York, you have to do very well with black and Hispanic voters in New York City. I think some people who don't live in New York sometimes underestimate how much of New York State is New York City. It's very much like how London dominates British politics, because like half of British people live in London. New York City, it dominates New York politics. You have to have very, very strong support outside of New York City if you're not in New York, if you don't have strong support in New York City to win anything. Even then, I don't know if it's possible. So if you guys enjoyed that, next week we are going to be talking to Candace Valenzuela, a former congressional candidate and a former member of a school board here in Texas. And we're going to be talking to her about the school to prison pipeline. I'm very excited about that episode. I think it's going to be great. There's some really shocking information, some very shocking statistics about the way that our school system funnels people into the criminal justice system. I think it's a travesty. So definitely be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss that. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to rate us and review us if you're on a platform that allows for that. Apple, Google, I don't believe Spotify does. But if you are on a platform that allows for that, be sure to rate and review us so that more people find our podcast. And be sure to share us with a friend, a coworker, an enemy, a family member, anyone who you think would listen. The number one way that podcasts grow is by word of mouth, so definitely be sure to do that. And also follow us on social media, on Facebook at The Explanation Pod, on Twitter at @explanation_pod.
Yes.
And on Instagram at The Explanation Pod.
Yes.
There we go.
And if you ever want to reach us, write us an email at info@theexplanationpod.com.
Thank you for joining us.
I think you're going to get some hate mail about confusing Brooklyn with Bronx.
Possibly. I'm prepared. I'm prepared for that.
Okay. That's fine.